Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you click on that events page so you can come and register for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's October 15th and 16th. If you want to hang out with me, Chad, a whole bunch of other people, we're going to be talking about the assurance we have in Christ. If you're in the Southwest, you got to make the drive. I mean, you're in Southern California, you're in Arizona. Obviously, if you're in Nevada, any places like that, come on over. New Mexico, you drive it. If you want to fly over, that's what I'm doing. That's what Chad's doing. We're flying. You could get in a plane as well. Come and hang out with us. We'd love to see you there. All the information is on the site. Chad, we are in 2 Samuel 18. We have seen David's friend give Absalom some advice that he has taken over other advice. And this advice has given David a little bit of time to put some distance between him and Absalom. It's given him probably time to acquire, it seems, as we're going to see, more people to his side. Now, we're not given all the details of that, but by the way it reads, it seems that David has utilized this breathing room to amass to himself more alliances, because David fled with some servants, but David's got legitimate forces now. And it's sort of all going to come to a head here in 2 Samuel 18.
Yeah, and we're not told this, but I can imagine, just kind of putting yourself in that situation, that there were, you know, when word got out, the coup had taken place, and here's what was happening with Absalom, here's what's happening with David. You can imagine that a lot of people who, you know, they like David, they've been faithful to David, as soon as they hear about it, they're like, okay, where's David at? Because I'm going to go team up with him, because I'm on his side. So probably you had a lot of the men of Israel who went with David, and you had, of course, a lot who went with Absalom. So it's kind of a divided forces. So this would have taken some time. We're not told how long, but long enough to where both groups, both that of the usurper Absalom as well as King David, they had their guys. Now the question is, of course, what's going to happen? Well, when we stopped last time at the end of chapter 17. We have David being helped out by some new friends who are bringing him and his troops all of these provisions and whatnot. Now, as soon as we get into chapter 18, it's jumping immediately into the conflict. So, and it's, you know, actually it's over pretty quickly. There's a lot of buildup to this, right? We've been talking about this for a while, all the kind of the beginning of the coup, and even before then when Absalom was stealing the hearts of the men of Israel. So this particular story has been a long time building up to this point.
And this seems like exactly what Ahithophel was trying to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he wanted to, let's get this over with, right? Let's cut to the chase. Let's take him out and it'll be done with. Take David out, you cut off the head and the rest of the body's dead. So take out David and we're good. That would have been, of course, good advice for Absalom to follow, but the Lord had his way. And so instead, he followed the advice of Hushai. And he's going to find out very quickly that he listened to the wrong advisor. So 18 starts out this way. David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands, commanders of hundreds. So it's kind of a typical military organization here where you have, you know, different kinds of ranks, different kinds of leaders over different sizes of warriors. Now, this is a surprise. So that part's no surprise. This is a surprise. David sent out his army. Now, listen to this. One third under the command of Joab. One third under the command of Abishai. Now, that's Joab's brother. They're both the son of Zeruiah, David's sister. So one third under Joab, one third under his brother Abishai, and one third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. So this is crazy. So one third of David's men are under a Philistine commander. Ittai is from the city of Gath. Of course, Gath being a Philistine city. So if you're from Gath, you're called a Gittite. So this is, it's kind of, if you know all of David's history, that part is wild. Here's a guy who's known as the Philistine killer. I mean, his claim to fame was as a kid, he killed the Philistine giant from Gath. Now, fast forward, he's now a king. He's an old guy. He's in the middle of a coup. And who does he get to command? A third of his men. A guy from Gath, a Philistine named Ittai. So that's crazy. But I think the part that is especially noteworthy, and you and I have talked about this when we weren't recording, is that only a third of the men are under the command of Joab.
Yeah, so it does seem that David needs Joab, but he's a little skeptical of Joab. After all, Joab is the one that convinced him that he should welcome Absalom back. So I suppose you could, if you tried to look at things from David's perspective, you could think, like, this wouldn't have happened if you hadn't, you know, tried to compel me to let my son come home. I'm sure Joab would say, well, when I said let your son come home, I didn't mean for you to also, you know, not let him ever come into your presence if you treat him like he wasn't your son. So I'm sure if you asked the two of them whose fault this is, they might be pointing at each other. If I was mediating, I would say this is probably more David's fault than Joab's, because I think what Joab was trying to do was probably, from a theological perspective, it was of course the right thing to do, and David blew it when he didn't respond the way that God would respond when his prodigal son comes home, and this is sort of the result. But either way, it does seem that Joab is probably looking over there at that Philistine commander in charge of exactly the same amount of men as he is, being like, what is going on?
Yeah, I'm sure that rubbed him the wrong way. So, but that's the situation. That's what David decides. So,
and what's also interesting is, you know, David is a military guy. David has been in, was as it was a general for Saul, commander of Saul's armies. He's not in charge of these troops. So it wasn't as though David took a third and Joab took a third and someone else took a third. So David has divided his army up among other commanders. And so he's not going to sort of play the role of general king here.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a good comparison, I suppose, but he's kind of like the American commander in chief, you know. Mm-hmm. He's not going to go out there and actually fight. He's right. Going to be like the president. He's got his generals and he's delegated to them responsibility of doing what needs to be done to stop the forces of Absalom. But notice what he says. He does want to go out. The king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. And the men are like, ain't happening. There's no beating around the bush here. I mean, they are blunt. You shall not go out.
Yeah, this is it.
They're not like, thanks for offering, but we're good.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because David doesn't put himself in command of like one of the armies, but he just says, like, I'm just going to go out there with you guys. So he's just going to go play the role of warrior. The men are like, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, plus it just kind of puts everything at a disadvantage for everybody else, because as they go on to say, if we have to retreat, they're not going to care about us. In fact, if they take out half of the army, they're not going to care about us. Then they say, you're worth 10,000 of us. By that, they mean that if 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 of us die, well, the battle is going to go on. That's not the issue. But if you die, it's all over. So it's better that you send us help from the city. That is the city of presumably Mahanaim. So if we need help, we'll send messengers back. You can send more troops. So they more or less say, listen, you're the king. Be better if you stayed behind. Let us go and fight. And then you can orchestrate events from back here at the city.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is this is the opposite of the advice that Absalom is following, which is like, you kind of need to be out there, man.
Yeah. It's sort of a weird thing that what ends up happening is that the counsel of Ahithophel is followed, except it's David who takes that particular approach.
Yes.
So Ahithophel said to Absalom, you stay behind, or at least he implied that. Now David stays behind. And also Ahithophel counseled, just take out the one guy, take out David. And now pretty much what's going to happen, I mean, more guys will die, of course, but the focus of their attack is going to be the one man, take out Absalom. So in a strange sort of way, Ahithophel's advice was followed. It just was followed by the opposing army. So David agrees. He says, I'll go out. The guys say, no, you stay behind. And the king really doesn't put up much of an objection. He says, whatever seems best to you, that's what I'm going to do. So kind of, you know, I almost get the impression that they didn't have to twist his arm. Like he was like, oh, okay. I'll stay behind. all the while. It's kind of what he wanted to do anyway. So what does he do? Well, he doesn't just stay behind. We're told in verse 5, the king stood at the side of the gate. Now, the reason I think this is significant is because that might sound familiar to you. It just so happens that was precisely the stance that Absalom used to take in the city of Jerusalem when people were coming to get some sort of justice from the king. He would stand at the gate. And of course, if you remember, when people would show up, he'd like, you know, shake their hand, like, hey, where are you from? Why are you coming to the city? Oh, man, sorry, you're not going to get any justice at all from the king. But if I were king, everything would be different. So, in kind of an irony here, the king has placed himself by the side of this city gate. And while that's happening, all his army is marching out by the hundreds and by the thousands. Then, verse 5. At this point, the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, so the three leaders of the three-thirds of his army. He gives them only this particular command. So he really doesn't tell them what to do, except what not to do, or maybe how to approach this. These are the only instructions that are recorded. Deal gently, for my sake, with the young man Absalom.
Now, this is the one thing he wants them to do is going to be a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, how do you deal gently with someone with whom you're at war?
Yeah, and the way to end this is to remove him. So I don't know if he's saying, I prefer you take him alive. Is this a nice way of saying that? Mm-hmm. Seems like maybe that's what it is. Like that they would, if it's possible, I'd rather you just capture him.
Yeah, the indication is that that's exactly what was going on here, because we'll see in just a minute that when one of the soldiers repeats the command of the king, he changes the verb. He says that we are to shamar Absalom, and shamar means to guard or to watch. So, or protect even. There's this idea that David wants them to shield, to guard, to protect, to deal gently with Absalom. Now, for me, the question is, maybe question isn't the right word, but I'm thinking to myself, why all of a sudden is there a change in David's behavior toward Absalom? And we're going to see in later in the chapter, after David is informed of the death of Absalom, that he has a complete emotional breakdown. And he just loses it when he finds out that Absalom is dead. Which, given everything we know about David and Absalom's rocky relationship, at least in the past couple chapters, this is odd that David would be brought to this point. And I don't know what's going on with David. I mean, is he finally kind of at the point where he realizes that this whole situation with Absalom's rebellion and the coup and everything is his fault, that he's the one who started all this, in other words. You know, it was everything that we covered with David and Bathsheba and Uriah, that was the event, that was the epicenter from which all of these other events have rippled out. So is David actually at the point where he's like, you know, this whole situation really starts with me. The buck stops here. I don't know, but it just kind of me speculating here as to, because this does seem to me at least a strange turn on David's part, where all of a sudden now he cares about Absalom.
Yeah, it seems like as he's out in the wilderness, he's on the run. Perhaps maybe he's realized, like, you know, if I had handled the rape of my daughter differently, if I would have handled Absalom coming home differently, this may not be happening. Also, you know, he's got an army going out against Absalom, and in all of these other situations, he might be treating Absalom harshly, but he's not sentencing him to death. And Absalom, I mean, we saw that where Absalom even knows that that's not going to happen. Like, he says, "Hey, if I'm guilty, then go ahead and, you know, do what you want to do with me." And mm-hmm. David doesn't do anything. But now he's faced with the reality that his army might just be going out there to kill his son, and it's probably sinking in that this probably could have been avoided if I would have been a little softer.
Yeah, I think he's, part of this is that regret over his decisions and just you know, simple fatherly love toward Absalom. This is, you know, this is his son. So all of that combined, given, you know, what might happen to Absalom, all of that is changing his perspective.
Yeah, you've probably been angry at people you love before, and maybe even angry with people you love for long periods of time. But if the moment then came like, well, now you have to kill him, that changes things a little bit. There's a difference between being upset with somebody, even for a long period of time, and then, and now we have to go kill him. Well, okay, that's different.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, David has already shown in the case of Shimei, that guy who was cursing him while he was leaving the city, that he's not out for blood. He doesn't want to take anybody out. So there is this growing awareness within David of all the events that have led up to this, beginning with him, kind of a growing, I guess, maybe compassion or even love toward enemies that we see happening with him. So that's why he says what he does. He's like, hey, deal gently with the young man Absalom. And we're told at the end of verse 5 that he didn't just say this kind of privately to his three generals, Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, but everybody heard it. All the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So this is a, you almost get the feeling that David says this, not just to his generals, but to everybody, so that everybody is aware, okay, this is where the king stands. I want not just you three generals, but everybody, deal gently with my son Absalom. So no one is going out there unaware of what David has said. Now, the reason this becomes important is what we'll see in the next chapter.
Yeah,
I almost get
the impression that David is at the gate. Everyone's riding through, and he's like shouting this out. It's like, yeah, like it's like the last, his last, like he's realizing what is going on right here, and he's probably just shouting this out over and over again as the army rides through, that this is his instruction.
Yeah, this is his wish. You're going out to battle. Okay, I want you to go to battle, but here's the one thing I want you to keep in mind.
Yeah, it seems like there's a little bit of a desperation there.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Desperation is probably the best way to describe it. Well, what happens? Verse 6 picks it up, and it's a very brief report. We're not really given a whole lot of details. We're told the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. So the forest part is significant because of what's about to happen to Absalom. This isn't an up on the plain or anything like that. This is in the midst of trees and shrubs and everything else that is part of a forest. Verse 7, the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. So even though Absalom was really the one they needed to take out, a lot of other men died, and that 20,000 men were killed tells you the army on Absalom's side was a significant number of soldiers, but they lost. They were defeated that day, and we're told that the battle, this is interesting, verse 8, the battle spread over the face of all that country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. I think a couple of things could be going on here. Literally, the forest ate more people that day than the sword. This is the image of the forest eating them up. Could simply be that everything was so thick. You had trees, you had shrubs, you had drop-offs, you had pitch, you had hills, you had just, you've been in a forest. You know what it's like to try and even walk through there. Well, imagine trying to take a bunch of troops through there and horses and mules and everything that were part of this army. A forest is not a place you want to go fight. So it could simply be that, you know, in the midst of people getting hurt and knocked off the horse and everything else, that they were defeated in that way. They were eaten up, as it says, by the forest. This could, I'm not saying it is, but it could be one of those instances that we've seen other times where God enlists creation itself as kind of a soldier on his side. We've seen how, like back in the book of Judges, where the stars were falling from heaven or hail falls upon people. There's a lot of instances in the Old Testament where God enlists the forces of nature to actually do battle, usually in conjunction with his people, against whoever the adversaries might be. Now, this is a stretch, admittedly, but when I read that verse, I had the image of like Treebeard and the Ents in Lord of the Rings. They're like, but reaching down with these arms as branches and taking out troops. I don't think that's probably what's happening here, but that was the image that leapt into my mind when I heard about the forest eating up all these soldiers on Absalom's side.
Yeah, you wonder too if part of this is if you have a battle being fought this way, and if the battle starts to turn, if you just have a lot of people that have decided they're out, and they've just deserted. So like you're in a forest, and you just realize like we're not fighting in an open field. I can desert. Like nobody's gonna know.
Slip away. Nobody's gonna know. Yeah.
And if that plays into it as well, that sort of like people sort of are disappearing into the forest, right? Where they're like, okay, that's it. I'm not doing this.
Oh, I'm sure there was plenty of that going on, as you know, as happened in all ancient warfare. You know, people are, if they see they've lost, it's like, why stick around?
Yeah, and then when you know, when they, if it goes that way, then you just say, oh, I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got
a great place to hide and an easy way to escape. So I'm sure a lot of that was happening as well. Although we are told in verses 9 and following that what did happen was that one of the trees actually did take out one of the people, at least trapped him. Verse 9, this is, of course, a famous scene from the Old Testament. Absalom, what happened to him? Well, he happened to meet the servants of David. He was riding on his mule, which, of course, as we've seen several times, mules were a regal transport. He's not on a horse. He's on this regal animal, which you can kind of picture as you can kind of link his regal mount to his throne, if you will. He's about to lose his throne. So Absalom's riding on this symbol of regal authority, his mule. The mule goes under the branches, under the thick branches of a great oak. Could also be translated terebinth. But whatever the tree was, he goes under the branches. And his head caught fast in the oak. Now, it doesn't mention his hair, but virtually all the commentators that I've looked at agree that when it says head, it's not talking about his head, it's talking about the hair on his head, which, of course, is why the hair was brought up a couple of chapters ago and how he would grow it long and then he would cut it at the end of every year. So putting everything together, it seems what happened. He's riding along, probably trying to get away. His donkey, his mule goes under the branch of this oak. Something happens, you know, and his hair flops up and his hair gets caught in the branches of the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. It crossed over. By the way, that's that same Hebrew verb that we saw with David crossing over or crossing out of Jerusalem. So this is kind of the idea of his mule is moving on and leaves him behind. So here we have the would-be king losing his mount, kind of losing his throne. He's dangling there between heaven and earth in the same way that Ahithophel would have been suspended when he hanged himself. There's some kind of overlap here between these two particular stories. And he can't do anything.
Yeah, you do almost get the picture of him riding in a tree, just reaching out and grabbing him by the hair.
Treebeard reaches down and grabs him by the hair.
Yeah.
I mean, it really does. It you get that feeling. And it's not, given the whole the breadth of biblical narrative and all the stories there, it's not out of the question whatsoever that God would say to that tree, it's like he spoke to all other sorts of elements of creation, do this. And they did it. God said to the fish, swallow Jonah. God said to the hailstones, fall on those guys. God said to the Sea of Galilee, Sea of the Red Sea or the Jordan River, part. I mean, God's doing that all the time.
Yep.
Right? So would no big deal to say to a tree, hey, grab that dude's hair. Mm. And it did. So there he is. It's an unforgettable image of Absalom hanging there by this symbol of his vanity, the symbol of his kind of narcissistic focus upon his own body, and he's just lost his regal mount, just like, of course, he's lost his throne. He's all alone. Nobody's with him. So he's lost everybody that was on his side. and he's helpless. There's nothing that he can do. And there's almost almost indication too of him being in a kind of a cursed place, because back in Deuteronomy as well as elsewhere, we're told that he who is hanged from a tree is cursed.
Right.
You know, that it's talking about someone who is literally hanged, executed, but still that resonates here as well. Here we have the cursed one who's suspended between heaven and earth. So he has kind of this image of between heaven and earth is like he's lost every place. He doesn't belong above. He doesn't belong below. He's just there. So what's going to happen to him? That's the question. Verse 10 says that somebody spotted him. A certain man saw it, and he goes and reports to Joab. So he doesn't do anything to him. He just reports what he saw. He says, look, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. Joab is angry. He's like, what? You saw him? Well, why didn't you kill him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground? In fact, I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt if you'd done it. You kind of get the impression that Joab had let it be whispered among the troops, hey, I got a reward for anybody who takes out Absalom. I know what David said, but just, you know, kind of let it be known, whisper among the troops that if somebody does take out Absalom, their pocket's going to be full of silver from me. I personally will reward them. So what does the guy say back to Joab? He said, verse 12, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, in our hearing, we all heard this, the king commanded you and your brother Abishai and Ittai, the guy from Gath, he commanded all of us, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. That verb protect is the one I mentioned earlier, that shamar, to guard, to watch over, to protect the young man Absalom. So this soldier is like, no way. You heard it, I heard it, we all heard it. David said, don't lay a hand on the young man Absalom. And so I don't care how much money you pay me, ain't happening. You almost get the impression this guy was like Uriah, right? Uriah's like, I'm not going to go to my house and wash my feet and eat and drink and sleep with my wife. I'm a man of military integrity. I'm not doing that. And this guy's like, yeah, I don't care. If I had 10,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I am not going to stretch out my hand against the king's son. I heard what he said, and what the king says is what I'm going to do. So he goes on. On the other hand, this is a pretty smart guy. He's like, listen, I'm not going to do that, but say I had, okay, just for the sake of argument, say that I had dealt treacherously against his life. Say I did kill him. And, you know, there's nothing hidden from the king. He's going to find out. Then what would happen? You, Joab, you yourself would have stood aloof from me. He's got Joab figured out. He's like, first of all, I ain't killing Absalom. David said not to. I'm not doing it. But just suppose I did. Well, when all the fingers were pointed at me, you would have just like vanished into the crowd. You would have stood aloof. You're not going to be like, oh yeah, well, actually, David, I told him that I would reward him if he did this.
Yeah, he's thinking like, I feel like this is probably one of those like old school David rewards, where yeah, you get a little, where David's got a little something for you. Like, he's like, dude, I ain't doing that. Like, and I don't think that you would have had my back if I did do that. Of course, Joab's gonna be like, well, you think wrong, because Joab's about to put his money where his mouth is right here.
Yeah, he is. So this soldier says that. Joab, verse 14, says, I'm not going to waste my time with you. Listen, I'm not wasting any more breath talking to you. I'll take care of it myself. So he does. He said he took, well, so it took, the ESV says he took 3 javelins. I think the New American Standard says he took 3 spears. Actually, I've read different things here. So the word that's used here, the noun that's used here, that's translated to the javelin or spears, literally means a staff or a stick. So it's not the typical word that you have for spear. It's not the typical word that you have for javelin. So it almost comes across as just maybe it's a sharp stick. I don't know. It's strange in a way, but he takes these three instruments, wooden objects, and he thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive. Now, literally, it says while he was still alive in the heart of the oak. So the word for heart is repeated twice, although most English translations don't have that second one there. So two hearts. He thrust them into the heart of Absalom while Absalom was still alive in the heart of the oak. So he's hanging there, and Joab either strikes him hard on the heart, or actually, you know, if it's a true javelin or spear, he thrust them into his heart. Whatever it was, he didn't take him down. He didn't cut his hair off and let him fall to the ground. He does this while he's still hanging there, defenseless in the oak. And then Joab, being, you know, he's a smart guy, he doesn't want to be the one who takes the entire blame for doing this. So he gets his 10 fellow warriors, 10 young men, his armor bearers, and they surround Absalom, and they, too, strike him and kill him. Of course, Joab is thinking ahead. He's like, okay, I know that David is going to be like, who killed Absalom? Well, I'll be able to say, oh, man, I don't know. There were a bunch of guys that hit him all at once. So he's spreading the blame among a whole bunch of his other troops.
And this is an interesting thing for Joab, because, I mean, Joab was sympathetic to Absalom. We've seen that. Joab wanted Absalom to come home. It does seem that Joab is probably pretty angry with Absalom at this point, that this is how he had sort of returned the favor, right? And so, I mean, set his field on fire, and then also, look what they're having to deal with. And if I was Joab, I would be fairly irritated with Absalom and David at this point, because Joab seems like he had the right idea from the beginning, and these two guys did not want to cooperate.
Yeah, I think you're right. Both of them created this situation. David, by refusing to welcome Absalom back as the prodigal son. Absalom, by being angry and staging the coup. And so both father and son have angered Joab. And of course, he can't take out his fury on David, but he does take it out on Absalom.
It seems like maybe Joab, even when trying to get Absalom to come home to David trying to have David welcome him home, was maybe even trying to avoid something like this, like knowing that, like, hey, it's not great when the king's sons are angry with him. Like, we got to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how bad things happen. Yeah. And it just didn't work.
Yeah. And now we have a whole heap of bad things happening. And, you know, you put yourself in Joab's shoes. Okay, what if they did deal gently with Absalom or guarded him? How is that going to end well?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You're going to bring him in handcuffs back to David, and then what's going to happen? You're going to keep him in prison? You're going to kind of give him a royal pardon? I mean, none of that's going to end well from Joab's perspective. And so he decides that he's going to just take care of the situation right there and assume that it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. So he's going to actually take out Absalom while he's there. So he does. He's dead. Verse 16 says that Joab blew the trumpet. There's a pretty kind of creative play on words here in the Hebrew, which I don't think you can ever actually bring out in English, but the verb for thrust, like he thrust those sticks into the heart of Absalom, and the verb for translated here is blew the trumpet, are the exact same word. It's the idea that this trumpet made kind of a piercing sound. That's the connection between these two. So the spears or javelins or sticks pierced Absalom's heart. Joab now pierces the air with the sound of the trumpet. The troops come back from pursuing Israel. Joab restrains them. And what they do with Absalom, it says they took him and they threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. So an ignominious end for Absalom. When I read that phrase, raised over him a great, very great heap of stones, I was like, man, that sounds familiar too. So I went back and I checked to see how the burial of Achan way back in Joshua 7 was described. And the Hebrew is not exact, but it's very close. What they do with Achan, remember Achan was the one who stole the forbidden materials from the city of Jericho. As a result, Israel lost their next battle at the city of Ai. And then they cast lots, finally figured out that Achan was the one who was to blame because he had taken the forbidden goods, and they stoned him. And they raised over him a great heap of stones. So not exactly the same in the Hebrew, but extremely close as to what happened with Absalom and now what happens with Achan, both of whom, of course, had betrayed Israel, had rebelled against God, and thus both met the same sort of end. And then all Israel, that is the people who are on Absalom's side, they take off. Everybody flees back to his own home. Then we have a contrast here. So this is the way Absalom was buried, just thrown into a pit, great heap of stones put over his body. But verse 18, I think that's the reason this is inserted here. It is a contrast. Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up for himself the pillar that's in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. I mentioned two or three episodes ago that Absalom was said to have three sons, and now here it says he has no son. Most commentators simply explain this, that at this point in Absalom's life, he's actually lost. Mm-hmm. All three of the sons have died. And so he doesn't say, I've never had a son. He just says, I have no son. So no living son to keep my name in remembrance. And because of that, he erects this monument. And as I say, I think the reason this is inserted here into the narrative is to contrast this monument that he set up in his own honor and the way that he was memorialized in a very negative sort of way by having all these stones heaped over his body.
Yeah, it seems that there's a little bit of body hiding going on here, first of all. Probably Joab doesn't think it's any good to bring the body of Absalom back to David and be like, man, here, your son was stabbed 30 times or whatever. That seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, this is not like hauling Goliath's head back to Saul.
No.
This would be a bad idea.
So you have that. And then, Absalom is, he ends up being a bad dude. But if you look back, on his life, and if you do think like, oh, this is a guy that like has had three sons and they all died. This is a guy whose sister, whom he loved enough to name his daughter after, was raped, and his father didn't do anything about it. And so then he took it matters into his own hands and got revenge for that, and then was mistreated by his father and cast out and never really welcomed back. Even when he was welcome to come home, he was not allowed to be in his father's presence and that sort of stuff. And when you take all of that into consideration, you realize like kind of what a tragic figure Absalom is, and that his life was marked by quite a bit of suffering.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I mean, it is a tragedy. Now, this guy, it wasn't like we're dealing here with just a terribly horrible, evil person who spent his whole life just wreaking havoc. This is like so many stories. This story could have been extremely different. And he suffered a lot. I mean, I can't imagine losing one child. I certainly can't imagine losing three children, not to mention all the other tragedies that befell him in his life. So you can see why and how Absalom ended up the place that he did, and you can also see how he is a tragic figure. And this whole story, in fact, is part of this kind of ripple effect, this ripple tragic effect that goes all the way back to those earlier chapters. And at the same time, you can also, as you see it in the bigger context, you can see these various theological themes that are emerging as well, where God is still behind the scenes. He's not front and center, but he's always behind the scenes, and he is working the history toward the direction that he wants it to go, because it won't be Absalom, but it'll be Solomon, who will eventually be David's successor. And we'll get there, but as with all these Old Testament stories, we'll get there through a whole bunch of ups and downs and twists and turns and going kind of through a maze. What looks to us like a maze anyway is actually how God is directing all these events.
Yeah, God still has a promise that he intends on keeping. All right, well, next week we will we'll hear about David's response to the news that Absalom has died. That response is going to be quite emotional. We'll tackle that next week. I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.